From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The vast majority of New Orleans, Louisiana is underwater. Tens of thousands of homes and businesses are beyond repair. A lot of the Mississippi Gulf Coast has been completely destroyed. Mobile is flooded. We are dealing with one of the worst natural disasters in our nation's history.
Today, states of catastrophe. Hurricane Katrina, it was not a matter of if, but when. So where was the federal government?
People had been warning about this disaster and exactly this scenario for years, but the money and the political will never existed to address it.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from Hurricane Katrina continues to climb dramatically, with the mayor of New Orleans estimating the number of dead in his city could well be in the thousands. He described dead bodies yet to be recovered floating through the water-soaked streets of New Orleans. The White House has declared a public health emergency for the entire Gulf Coast, as the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Mike Leavitt warned of potential outbreaks of cholera and typhoid. President Bush cut short his vacation in Crawford, Texas. Upon his return to Washington, he addressed the nation on television.
As we flew here today, I also asked the pilot to fly over the Gulf Coast region so I could see firsthand the scope and magnitude of the devastation. The vast majority of New Orleans, Louisiana is underwater. Tens of thousands of homes and businesses are beyond repair. A lot of the Mississippi Gulf Coast has been completely destroyed. Mobile is flooded. We are dealing with one of the worst natural disasters in our nation's history.
President Bush speaking yesterday. He returned from Crawford 2 days after the storm hit. If the estimates that the death toll could go into the thousands prove true, that would make Katrina the deadliest natural disaster in the United States since at least the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. As Bush spoke, the Pentagon said the governors of Louisiana and Mississippi have ordered the mobilization of an additional 10,000 National Guard troops to provide security and help with hurricane relief. The latest deployment will double the number of National Guard troops deployed to the area. According to the commander of the National Guard, fully one-third of the 21,000 troops will be used to prevent looting, enforce curfews, and bolster local law enforcement. According to the Pentagon, 7,200 active-duty military troops are responding to the disaster. Meanwhile, some 3 million people in Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, and Florida will remain without electricity. President Bush ordered Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff to coordinate a massive recovery campaign that could take years to complete. This is Chertoff.
Truckloads of water, ice, meals, medical supplies, generators, tents, and tarpaulins. There are currently over 1,700 trailer trucks which have been mobilized to move these supplies into position. The Coast Guard has worked heroically for the last 48 hours, rescuing or assisting well more than 1,000 people who were in distress and held high and dry above the floodwaters.
Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff. The total evacuation of New Orleans has begun. More than 25,000 people who had sought refuge in Louisiana Superdome are now being bused to the Houston Astrodome, as are some of the neediest patients at hospitals. Some 475 buses have begun loading up passengers. In addition to the Astrodome solution, the Federal Emergency Management Agency was considering putting people on cruise ships in tent cities, mobile home parks, and so-called floating dormitories. The federal government dispatched helicopters, warships, and elite SEAL water rescue teams in one of the biggest relief operations in U.S. history. Officials say it's aimed at rescuing residents from rooftops in the last of what are called the golden 72 hours that rescuers say is crucial to saving lives. The Washington Post described a scene on shattered Interstate 10 where hundreds of people wandered up and down the only major freeway leading into New Orleans from the east. People pushed shopping carts, laundry racks, and anything they could find to carry their belongings. On some of the few roads that were still open, people waved at passing cars with empty water jugs begging for relief. Hundreds of people appear to have spent the night on the highway. Thousands have lost everything they own in life, including their homes and businesses. Entire communities have been wiped out, and residents of New Orleans are now being told they may not be able to return to what's left of their city for months. Officials of the Army Corps of Engineers told the LA Times that draining the billions of gallons of water from New Orleans could take 3 to 6 months, substantially longer than many have predicted. Colonel Richard Wagner, the Corps' senior official in the city, said, quote, "The news cameras don't do justice, and I'm worried the worst is yet to come." The FEMA official, Michael Brown, who's leading the on-the-ground response from the federal government, said, quote, "I surmise there are people in New Orleans who won't be able to get back to their homes for months, if ever." The Washington Post points out New Orleans is now flooded by water spiked with tons of toxic chemicals and contaminants ranging from heavy metals and hydrocarbons to industrial waste, human feces, and the decayed remains of humans and animals. Experts say the contamination will continue to poison the Gulf of Mexico region for more than a decade. A senior policy analyst at the Environmental Protection Agency told the Post, quote, "This is the worst case. There is not enough money in the gross national product of the United States to dispose of the amount of hazardous material in the area." Meanwhile, in neighboring Mississippi, authorities now say at least 185 people have died. In Hancock County alone, Sheriff Eddie Jennings put the death toll at 85, with 60 people dead in Pearlington, 22 in Waveland, 2 in Bay St. Louis, and one body that had washed up on the beach. In neighboring Harrison County, which is home to Gulfport and Biloxi, officials say 100 bodies have been found. All these numbers are expected to grow as search and rescue operations continue. The city of Gulfport was almost destroyed. Biloxi, heavily damaged. Dozens of patients from a Biloxi hospital were evacuated by the U.S. Air Force Wednesday. Patients, including a ward full of women with high-risk pregnancies, were transported from the hard-hit area by Air Force cargo planes to San Antonio, Texas. Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour flew over the state's ravaged coastline and likened it to Hiroshima in 1945. In Alabama, more than 400,000 homes and businesses are without power, while Florida reported 11 deaths. As with most natural disasters, the poor are paying the heaviest price. With the financial world buzzing with talk of insurance payouts set to exceed $25 billion, many in the most devastated areas have no insurance and cannot afford to leave their homes behind. Many do not own cars and had no way to escape the hurricane. Meanwhile, despite the dire situation in New Orleans, the mayor, Ray Nagin, has ordered almost every one of the city's 1,500 police officers to leave their search and rescue mission Wednesday night and return to the streets to stop people from taking goods from stores and businesses. In some cases, violence has broken out as people looted stores. Several businesses report having their entire stock of guns and other weapons taken. And police officials report armed gangs roaming the streets. Desperate people Wednesday chased down a state police truck full of food, while city officials themselves were commandeering equipment from a looted Office Depot. In defending his decision to call the police off rescue missions, the mayor said, quote, "It's really difficult because my opinion of the looting is it started with people running out of food, and you can't really argue with that too much," he said. But last night, he issued a statement to the AP saying, quote, "They're starting to get closer to the heavily populated areas, hotels, hospitals, and we're going to stop it right now." Meanwhile, international leaders are joining the chorus of voices in this country saying that the government failed to prepare for a disaster it knew was imminent. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez blasted President Bush for waiting until after Hurricane Katrina hit the United States to end his vacation in Texas. At the same time, Chavez expressed sympathy for the storm's victims and repeated his offer to send aid workers to the devastated southern U.S. states. Meanwhile, Citgo, the U.S. subsidiary of Venezuela's state-owned oil giant, announced it would donate $1 million to U.S. aid organizations helping hurricane victims. This comes as gas prices in many U.S. cities spiked past the all-time highs set in 1981, with some drivers in Atlanta facing prices above $5 a gallon. Prices also rose significantly in many populated urban centers across the nation. Prices jumped just as Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman said Wednesday on CNBC the government was releasing crude oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, where more than 700 million barrels of crude oil are stored in caverns for emergency use. The Department of Interior estimates 95% of the Gulf of Mexico production has been shut down by Katrina. Some analysts are now predicting gas prices nationwide could soar to more than $4 a gallon. The publication Airport Business is reporting at least 10 U.S. airports could be shut down due to a lack of jet fuel caused by refinery and pipeline shutdowns from the hurricane. Airlines and oil companies are reportedly working on plans to supply jet fuel to the airports in jeopardy. They include Atlanta and Washington Dulles. NBC will hold a live telethon on Friday to raise money for the relief efforts, while the following Friday, Black Entertainment Television, BET, will host one. That effort will involve hip-hop activist and businessman Russell Simmons, the National Urban League, and jazz musician Wynton Marsalis. In non-hurricane news, Iraq has declared a three-day period of mourning after the massive stampede in Baghdad yesterday that killed some 1,000 Iraqis. Grieving relatives combed hospitals and morgues Thursday for missing loved ones as funeral tents were erected in the impoverished Baghdad Shiite suburb of Sadr City as relatives prepared to mourn their dead. At least 965 people are confirmed to have died during Wednesday's stampede as thousands of Shiite pilgrims took part in a religious festival. It remains unclear what exactly caused the stampede, but there was a barrage of mortar and rocket attacks on the crowd earlier in the day. Those attacks killed 7 people. There are reports that a warning from within the crowd of a suicide bomber among them sparked the panic. According to police officials, most of the victims were women and children who died from drowning or being trampled. Hundreds of people reportedly jumped or were thrown into the Tigris River. It's being described as the biggest loss of life in such a crowd since more than 1,400 pilgrims died at Mecca during the Hajj in 1990. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. And Amy, two extraordinary editorials came out this yesterday in two different parts of the country, both of them questioning seriously where was President Bush and what has the federal government been doing. I'd like to read from one of them. One is an amazing plea from the editorial board of the Sun Herald in Biloxi, Mississippi. South Mississippi needs your help. The coastal communities of South Mississippi are desperately in need of an unprecedented relief effort. We understand that New Orleans also was devastated by Hurricane Katrina, but surely this nation has the resources to rescue both that metropolitan and ours. Whatever plans that were in place to deal with such a natural disaster have proven inadequate. Perhaps destruction on this scale could not have been adequately prepared for. But now that it has taken place, no effort should be spared to mitigate the hurricane's impact. The editorial goes on to say, the essentials, ice, gasoline, medicine, simply are not getting here fast enough. We are not calling on the nation and the state to make life more comfortable in South Mississippi. We are calling on the nation and the state to make life here possible. And it goes on to say, with the flow of information, while the flow of information is frustratingly difficult, our reporters have yet to find evidence of a coordinated approach to relieve pain and hunger or to secure property and maintain order. People are hurting and people are being vandalized. Yet where is the National Guard? Why hasn't every able-bodied member of the armed forces in South Mississippi been pressed into service? On Wednesday, reporters listening to horrific stories of death and survival at the Biloxi Junior High School shelter looked across Irish Hill Road and saw Air Force personnel playing basketball and performing calisthenics. When asked why these young men were not being used to help in the recovery efforts, our reporters were told that it would be pointless to send military personnel down to the beach to pick up debris. Litter is the least of our problems. We need the president to back up his declaration of a disaster with a declaration of every man and woman under his command will do whatever is necessary to deal with that disaster. We need the governor to provide whatever assistance is at his command. We certainly need our own country and city officials to come together and identify the most pressing needs. A heartbreaking plea for help from the editorial board of the Sun-Herald in Biloxi, Mississippi, questioning how our government has been responding to the crisis. This was yesterday. And then in the New Hampshire Union Leader, an editorial yesterday, as the extent of Hurricane Katrina's devastation became clearer on Tuesday, millions without power, tens of thousands homeless, a death toll unknowable because rescue crews can't reach some regions, President Bush carried on with his plans to speak in San Diego as if nothing important had happened the day before. Katrina is already measured as one of the worst storms in American history, and yet President Bush decided that his plans to commemorate the 60th anniversary of VJ Day with a speech were more pressing than responding to the carnage. A better leader would have flown straight to the disaster zone and announced the immediate mobilization of every available resource to rescue the stranded, find and bury the dead, and keep the survivors fed, clothed, sheltered, and free of disease.
And again, that was from the New Hampshire Union Leader, one of the most conservative papers in the country.
Yes, and I think it was clear. Finally, the federal government got together, the cabinet, without President Bush initially, and Dick Cheney, who is still on vacation in Wyoming. President Bush finally came on the air in the evening to announce an all-out mobilization.
Well, Juan, we're going to begin today by going to New Orleans, a second part of our conversation with Bill Quigley. He's a law professor at Loyola University, currently trapped with hundreds of other people, perhaps more than 1,000, at Memorial Medical Center on Napoleon Avenue, without food, water, or electricity. Now, I spoke to him on a cell phone on Tuesday night, early Wednesday morning from the hospital. He'd been volunteering there since the hurricane hit, helping his wife, Debbie, who's an oncologist nurse. We learned that the staff was told they should not speak to the press, but of course Bill Quigley is not on the staff of that hospital. We tried throughout yesterday to reach Bill Quigley, but we couldn't get through to him. A colleague who exchanged text messages with him told us his last message sent Wednesday evening read, "No water, sick, no heat, call somebody for help." When his colleague called the Red Cross, they told her they couldn't help and that she should call the Coast Guard. She tried for several hours to reach the Coast Guard without success. We'll go now to Bill Quigley. Again, this was speaking on Tuesday night from a major hospital in New Orleans, beginning by describing the situation at the hospital.
There are 1,300 people in this hospital, a couple of hundred of whom are patients, hundreds of family members of the patients, hundreds of staff, and everything, little babies, little children of staff members and that who came in. The only way you get people to work in a hurricane in New Orleans is that you tell them you can come in and bring your whole family with you. So people brought their children, and so we got little babies, we got parents, we got that sort of stuff. But there's about 1,300 people here in this hospital. At this point now, there's about 5-plus feet of water outside the hospital, and they've lost power in the main stairwells. The power is reduced throughout the entire building. We don't have air conditioning, and the building is sealed, so you can't open to get, you know, even a breeze. So it's pretty hot in here. And on the upper floors, they don't have enough water pressure to be able to use the toilets and that. So we have areas that don't have electricity, areas that don't have any water pressure, and the water is rising. And shortly, when the water gets high enough, we will lose the electricity that we do have in the internal communication abilities that we have. We're here on the oncology and bone marrow unit where my wife works, and I just came in as a volunteer to help out, and they have somebody had a transplant today, they have people with various types of cancer, chemotherapy, IV drips, blood, all this other stuff, you know, that's very electrical intensive and that. And so people are very nervous. They see what's happened, survived the hurricane with the incredible winds blowing, blew out some windows in the hospital. They had to shut a couple of parts of the hospital up because of blown windows with that. But then this morning, we really thought it was better. But then today, the water started rising, and the electricity started going out, and we've been on apparently backup generators for more than a day for most of the hospital. And we don't have a lot of food, we don't have a lot of water, but they're evacuating some people right now, but they've been evacuating for about 10 hours, and they've evacuated about 100 people. So they have another 1,200 that are here. And we have water problems. We've got
Bill. You talk about a preemie baby that was born today and other infants. What's happening to them?
Yeah. Well, you have a couple of different classes of infants. You have the infants of the staff members and family that are here in the hospital who are still here. Had the very tiny sick babies that were in the hospital that have been helicoptered out, but even when they're helicoptering out, they don't take the families with them. So there was one woman who delivered a preemie baby, and they put the baby in an incubator, and they had to walk the baby up 8 flights of stairs because the elevators don't work, and put the baby onto a helicopter with some other babies that they helicoptered out, but they left the mother behind. You know, they don't have room for the mothers. All they had was a helicopter full of babies that they're helicoptering to Baton Rouge, and then from there they're not sure where they're going. There's not a real clear plan about what's happening. They have people strapped to pallets and taped to a pallet, and what they're doing, because we don't have elevators, is it knocked a hole in the wall, and they're handing people on these pallets taped over, handing them through the wall, hole in the wall, putting people into the back of a pickup truck, 2 people at a time, taped into this thing, put a nurse in the back of the pickup truck, and then they drive up 8 flights of the parking lot to the roof, where some people then put a couple of them on the helicopters, and they're taking them off from there. But there's still, I mean, it's still a lot of very sick people. We have some people that have to get to Houston to the MD Anderson place over there, and they're telling us at this point they don't even know how that would happen.
And that was Bill Quigley, professor, law professor at Loyola University in the Memorial Hospital at Tenet in Louisiana, there with his wife, who is an oncology nurse and helping people there. Again, yesterday sent a text message out, and this is the last we've heard of him, from the hospital. This is almost 20 hours after we had spoken, which said, no water, sick, no heat, call somebody for help. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
If it keeps on raining, love is going to break. If it keeps on raining, love is going to break. And the water gonna come, I have no place to stay. Well, all last night I sat on the lever and moaned. Well, all last night I sat on the lever and moaned. Thinking about my baby and my happy home. If it keeps on raining, love is going to break. If it keeps on raining, love is going to break. And all these people have no place to stay. Look here, mama, what am I to do? Now look here, mama, what am I to do? I ain't got nobody to care my troubles to. I works on the lever, mama, both night and day. I works on the lever, mama, both night and day.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The death toll from Hurricane Katrina continues to climb dramatically, with the mayor of New Orleans estimating that the number of dead in the devastated city could well be into the thousands. Conditions continue to deteriorate after 2 levees broke, sending water coursing through the streets. An estimated 80% of the city, which lies below sea level, is underwater, up to 20 feet deep in places, with miles and miles of homes swamped. Food and water supplies are dwindling and bodies float in the floodwaters. As the evacuation of the Superdome begins, officials said there was no choice but to abandon the city, perhaps for months.
As the devastation continues to unfold, many people around the country are wondering how a catastrophe of this magnitude could have occurred. Well, some have been warning of such an impending disaster for years. 3 years ago, the New Orleans Times-Picayune won journalism awards for an exhaustive five-part series called Washing Away. It began with the words, "It's only a matter of time before South Louisiana takes a direct hit from a major hurricane. Billions have been spent to protect us, but we grow more vulnerable every day." The newspaper seems to be living its own prophecy. As the hurricane passed, but the water continued to rise, the staff of the Times-Picayune was forced to evacuate its downtown headquarters. We're joined right now by John McQuaid. He works in the Washington Bureau of the Times-Picayune. He is one of the co-authors of that 2002 series called Washing Away. We're also joined in Massachusetts by journalist Mark Fischetti. He's a contributing editor of Scientific American. In 2001, a year before Washing Away, he wrote the article entitled "The Drowning of New Orleans" that warned only massive reengineering of southeastern Louisiana could save New Orleans from a catastrophic flood. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!, and we begin with John McQuaid in Washington, D.C., the Washington reporter for the Times-Picayune. First of all, our condolences on all that is happening in your state and with your colleagues. Can you talk about your knowledge of the latest, but what you understood for years, what you've written about?
Well, the Corps of Engineers announced yesterday that the water coming into the city had stopped. Basically, the water inside the city kept rising, and the level of Lake Pontchartrain, which is the source of the water, was gradually falling after the storm, and those equalized sometime yesterday morning. So that gave them a little bit of relief, in at least that the situation was not worsening. They then were dropping giant sandbags, 15,000-pound sandbags, into the largest breach in the levee where the water had been coming in. And then they were going to embark on several projects to cut open levees at other places to allow water to flow out and to fix pumps that can pump water out. There have been different estimates as to how long it will take to pump all the water out. They were saying 30 days. I guess the Los Angeles Times was quoting someone saying it could take much longer than that. So that's sort of the flood situation.
And in terms of your series, could you, for those of our listeners and viewers around the country who are not familiar with it, talk about some of the main findings that that your series of articles uncovered?
Sure. There are two main problems. One is that the coastline, the entire region that New Orleans and its the surrounding areas are built on, is sinking and eroding due to a number of different factors. It's been doing that essentially since the people started living there. And over the years, it's gotten lower. They've built levees and other structures to prevent floodwaters from hurricanes and heavy rains and other things from staying in this area to get them out and keep them from penetrating into it. But the problem continues to get worse. So the government is constantly playing catch-up to construct levees, to build up existing structures, to build new structures, and essentially they never caught up.
We're also joined by Mark Fischetti, contributing editor of Scientific American. You wrote the piece, "The Drowning of New Orleans," warning that massive reengineering of southeastern Louisiana could save New Orleans from a catastrophic flood. Talk more about this. Talk about what you're seeing today and what you were warning. Not one, not two. Was it more than 3 years ago, in 2001?
Yeah, right. It was 2001, and what that was predicated on was actually a plan that was put together in 1998 by a number of local scientists, engineers, and the governor's office of Louisiana, which basically showed with computer models what would happen if a hurricane came in this direction and hit New Orleans directly. The models pretty much predicted exactly what's happened. So this whole group of experts down there came up with a pretty consolidated plan of four or five major steps that should be taken to protect the city and the Delta as much as possible. The plan came out and really didn't get a whole lot of response on a national level. It was an expensive program, as you might imagine, and it sort of was just left there.
And John McQuaid, your articles were amazingly describing the scenarios of experts that you talked to about the potential catastrophe in New Orleans from a direct hit from a hurricane. It's amazing how precisely those predictions have turned out to be as a result of this hurricane. Could you talk about what you warned then of the potential, how the disaster would play out?
Yes, all the experts looked at the basic topography, and they saw that New Orleans was on average 5 feet below sea level. The lake is 1.5 feet above sea level, and so all that's between them is a levee system. So if the levee system is overtopped by a large storm surge from a hurricane, or if it is breached, as happened in this case, then you get a flood the bowl situation where water just flows into the city from the lake, basically until it's at the same level in both. And that means essentially the entire city of New Orleans underwater. There's no easy way to get rid of that water. In most flood situations, in natural disasters, flood like the tsunami or river floods, the water will rise very quickly and then it will disappear relatively quickly. In this situation, it's just stuck there and there's no way to get it out. Electricity that powers the pumps is down. The pumps are inundated. They don't work. So you have a situation of standing water. As was mentioned at the top of the program, you have all the waste, garbage, dead bodies, some of it quite toxic, is just floating around in that. And it gets worse the longer it goes on. So the Corps of Engineers is desperately trying to get that water out of there. But again, it's the type of thing where you have to cut holes in the levee and pump the water out, and that just takes a very long time. So it's a very unique and horrible situation.
Well, as we reported yesterday and several other media have over the past few days, the federal government began a project in 1995 to shore up the levees and improve New Orleans' ability to withstand this type of flooding. But your newspaper has written many articles over the last few years talking about the problems with that program and the cutbacks that occurred in the funding for it. Could you talk about that as well?
There are basically two big programs underway. One has to do with flooding within the city and surrounding areas. The other has to do with hurricane protection and levee protection. The first is the one that had its funding cut. Some of that funding was also going to hurricane protection. In the past few years, it's been very difficult for local officials and members of Congress from Louisiana to get money consistently to fund those things. The Bush administration has obviously had its attention focused in terms of the budget on Iraq, on domestic terrorism. terrorism needs, and it's been looking to cut back in the Corps of Engineers. The Corps of Engineers has a history, some say, of wasting money on large projects. However, in this case, these projects are absolutely vital to protecting the city. So every year, there's been a big scramble to get more money. They've had some of it restored, but when you're sort of constantly fighting budget cuts coming from the administration, it's just been very difficult, and local people and members of Congress have been complaining about this for a long time.
President Bush proposing significantly reducing the amount of federal money, proposing spending $10 million, local officials saying six times as much money was needed. We want to talk now about the Department of Homeland Security and about the preparations for this. I mean, Juan, I guess this is the first major test of the newly consolidated Department of Homeland Security.
Yes. Well, the New Orleans mayor, Ray Nagin, estimated Tuesday that hundreds, maybe thousands of people have died since Hurricane Katrina hit the city. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is scrambling to find temporary housing for tens of thousands of people and to rescue people stranded on roofs and in the now uninhabitable Superdome. We turn now to the politics behind FEMA's relief efforts and ask the question, would Katrina have been so devastating if disaster relief had not been incorporated into the Department of Homeland Security?
FEMA was created in 1979 by President Carter, and President Clinton elevated the head of FEMA to a cabinet-level position in 92. But after September 11, 2001, President Bush moved the agency under the umbrella of the newly created Department of Homeland Security. While FEMA used to oversee both disaster preparedness and relief, now it's only in charge of post-disaster efforts. Critics say this narrower mandate limits the effectiveness of FEMA's work and that operating within the Department of Homeland Security consigns disaster relief to a lower priority than counterterrorism. President Bush spoke yesterday afternoon about the strategy of the federal government in coordinating relief efforts.
The people in the affected regions expect the federal government to work with the state government and local government with an effective response. I have directed Secretary of Homeland Security Mike Chertoff to chair a cabinet-level task force to coordinate all our assistance from Washington. FEMA Director Mike Brown is in charge of all federal response and recovery efforts in the field. I've instructed them to work closely with state and local officials, as well as with the private sector, to ensure that we're helping, not hindering, recovery efforts. This recovery will take a long time. This recovery will take years.
Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff highlighted the efforts of the Coast Guard at his news conference in Washington on Wednesday.
Truckloads of water, ice, meals, medical supplies, generators, tents, and tarpaulins. There are currently over 1,700 trailer trucks, which have been mobilized to move these supplies into position. The Coast Guard has worked heroically for the last 48 hours, rescuing or assisting well more than 1,000 people who were in distress and held high and dry above the floodwaters.
Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff. Thousands remain stranded in New Orleans and homes and hospitals with no running water and electricity. We now turn to look at the new infrastructure for disaster management in the U.S. We're joined by Matthew Brzezinski. He's author of Fortress America, on the front lines of Homeland Security, an inside look at the coming surveillance state. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. You've written for the New York Times Magazine. You've written for the Wall Street Journal about the Department of Homeland Security. What is happening here?
Well, I mean, I think that what we may be seeing is, as you mentioned earlier, is the first real test of, you know, whether this new department actually works. If you remember, the reason it was created was to streamline all the operations, to put everything under one umbrella, so that there is a clear chain of command, so that there's coordination and communication between all the various agencies. And this is the first time now we're going to see this put to the test. And I worry that in its growing pains. The Department of Homeland Security has not been very successful in amalgamating all 22 agencies. You know, these have vastly different corporate cultures. These often have been very competitive with one another in the past. And, you know, it takes a little bit of time to get everybody reading off one script. And you know, now we have this moment where really it is critical that, you know, we act quickly and efficiently, and it remains to be seen whether we'll do so.
Well, FEMA has always been an agency, a troubled agency, even from its inception through many natural disasters in decades past. It's been criticized for getting there late and often having a huge bureaucracy around it in terms of disaster relief. What do you think has dramatically changed in its ability to function, even though I think in previous years it had improved to some degree?
The short answer is more bureaucracy. I mean, at least before, FEMA answered to itself and to the president, but now FEMA has to answer to Mike Chertoff and the Department of Homeland Security, and there are all sorts of political considerations. As we heard, in the president had to make very clear that, well, Mike Chertoff is in charge, but Brown is down. It was going to be down in New Orleans, and, you know, unfortunately, politics often come into play. Who will get the credit? Who will get the blame? Whose jurisdiction? Who has authority over what? And so I think that we'll see one added layer of bureaucracy, and as I said earlier, remains to be seen whether that makes it more effective or even less effective.
Matthew Brzezinski, I mean, we know a lot about the Department of Homeland Security because of monitoring, some say spying on people here in this country, dealing with issues of terrorism as they define it. But isn't this the first major test of the Department of Homeland Security? It's dealing, whether this was a bomb or a hurricane, it's being in charge of all the forces to deal. And the question is, where were all of those forces? I watched an interview with Michael Green last night, the head of FEMA, and it was astounding to see that he said when he woke up on Monday morning, he understood, Michael Brown, he understood that this was going to be a catastrophe. President Bush was at Crawford for two more days. He said he understood on Monday that this could be a massive disaster. Now they're talking about bringing in the National Guard now, with so much of the National Guard all over this country in Iraq. But what about this?
Well, I mean, I think that you raise a good point, and I think we've been a little slow off the ball here. And, you know, this is one of the criticisms levied against the Department of Homeland Security is that it tries to be sort of all things to all problems. You know, DHS does everything from tracking foreign sex offenders to levying taxes on goods coming into the country, to, as you said before, monitoring potential terrorists, and now
defining affirmative action groups as terrorists. That's the latest.
And so it's got this huge agenda, and the problem is maybe it's just not focused enough, and I think something like this will highlight not only the need for a refocused either Department of Homeland Security, where you hive off certain duties from it, or you just narrow it. And I think it will also highlight something that's extremely important and it's been overlooked in Washington for a number of years now, and that is the importance of first responders. You know, this catastrophe, like the subway bombing in London, showed that, you know, either terrorist acts or acts of nature, well, they're not preventable, but you can mitigate the consequences if you're prepared, and getting people timely medical attention can save lives. And I think we saw that in London. Unfortunately, the first responders, and by first responders, it's a fairly wide category, which includes everything from firemen to ambulance drivers, EMS, local police, etc. They've really been at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of the money that we have been spending on Homeland Security. part of the problem, again, is that it's just not a sexy topic. It doesn't grab the media's attention. Okay, and the way that, say, WMDs do, weapons of mass destruction, or the same way that the TSA, the airport screeners do. And airport screeners get $5 billion a year. The first responders, in fact, are getting budget cuts. And again, because who's ultimately has to pay that? Is it a municipal? Is it state? Is it federal? So again, there's jurisdictional sort of overlap, and people can blame each other. And I spent a lot of time with first responders. And what I heard time and time again is, we give us the right equipment. We don't have the right equipment. We can't even talk to each other on our radios. So that a policeman can't necessarily talk to a fireman or an ambulance driver or an EMS or the Coast Guard, and how can you coordinate if you're not even on the same frequency?
Well, we're gonna have to leave it there. But I want to thank you very much, Matthew Brzezinski, for joining us, author of Fortress America. Also to Mark Fischetti, contributing editor of Scientific American, and John McQuaid at the Washington Bureau of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. In last hours, the managing editor of the Times-Picayune, Peter Kovacs, sent out a message to one of his reporters, Leslie Williams, a longtime hurricane reporter, has a lot of experience covering hurricanes, who was covering Katrina on the Mississippi coast. They cannot reach the reporter, and they're sending out a message for Leslie Williams to please contact the paper. They're very worried about Leslie Williams. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we will look at global warming and the disaster we're seeing in the Gulf. Stay with us. More water, come, more land, float away. People from Catahoula down to Berwick Bay, they've got no place left to stay. When the water come out the bay, there ain't nothing to waterproof. Standing on the levee with the river raging, I've got nothing left to lose. Big river, big river's on the rise. Big gonna overflow, big river is gonna wash us to the sea. Zydeco singer Zachary Richard, Big River, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The Bush administration has drafted regulations that would ease pollution controls on older, dirtier power plants and could allow those that modernize to emit more pollution rather than less. The language could undercut dozens of pending state and federal lawsuits aimed at forcing coal-fired plants to cut back emissions of harmful pollutants such as sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide. The draft rules were obtained by the Washington Post from the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Meanwhile, as the Gulf Coast struggles to cope with the devastation left behind by Hurricane Katrina, a number of analysts around the country and world are reflecting on the unusual severity of the storm and are making a connection with global warming in Germany. Environmental Minister Jürgen Tritten sparked a political firestorm this week when he penned an article in a German newspaper saying, quote, greenhouse gases have to be radically reduced worldwide. The U.S. has, up until this point, had its eyes closed to this emergency. He linked Hurricane Katrina to global warming and America's refusal to reduce emission. In 2001, the Bush administration announced it would not ratify the Kyoto Protocol that's been signed by 120 countries. The global treaty went into effect earlier this year without the support of the U.S. And in an article in the Boston Globe on Tuesday, journalist and author Ross Gilbspan writes, quote, the hurricane that struck Louisiana yesterday was nicknamed Katrina by the National Weather Service. Its real name is global warming. Gelbspan goes on to write, quote, unfortunately, very few people in America know the real name of Hurricane Katrina because the coal and oil industries have spent millions of dollars to keep the public in doubt about the issue. Ross Gelbspan joins us now from studio in Boston. As special projects editor of the Boston Globe, he conceived, directed, and edited a series of articles that won a Pulitzer Prize. He's author of The Heat Is On, The High Stakes Battle Over Earth's Threatened Climate. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ross Gelbspan.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Very good. Well, talk about what you're seeing as the connections right now.
It's very clear that global warming does not make more hurricanes, but it makes hurricanes much stronger. And that's because hurricanes take their energy from the temperature of surface waters. In the case of Katrina, it started as a Category 1, I think 70-mile-an-hour winds when it glanced off South Florida. But as it moved through the Gulf, where surface temperatures are about 80 degrees, it became enormously more powerful. I think the winds reached about 170 degrees. And that is a big reason for this incredible devastation that we've been seeing. It's very interesting that also Sir David King, who was Tony Blair's science advisor, made a direct link between hurricane intensity and global warming. And coincidentally, there was a piece of research done by Dr. Kerry Emanuel at MIT that came out just a couple of weeks ago that found that tropical storms had become 50% more severe in the last 30 years, again, because of rising temperatures.
Well, how do you respond, obviously, to all of the so-called experts who may say, well, it's true that there's global warming, but how can you pin a particular hurricane's impact or intensity to that general trend? It seems to me like, well, you may have been exposed to asbestos, but how can you prove that the lung cancer you have came from that exposure?
Because we're seeing this increase in intensity all over the place. July was the I think the second hottest July on record, and it triggered a record number of named tropical storms. So Hurricane Katrina fits right into the pattern here of what we're seeing. And just to stop for a second, if we look at some other events that have been happening the same year, not necessarily hurricanes, but we had a 2-foot snowfall in Los Angeles in January. We had 37 inches of rain in one day in Mumbai, India. We had this horrendous heat wave with 120 degrees in Arizona. We have the Missouri River just about empty because of a prolonged drought. All of these, including the intensity of hurricanes, are signatures of the warming of the planet.
I wanted to get your response, Ross Gelbspan, to the latest move of the Bush administration, cutting clean air regulations in this time of massive crisis. Can you talk about what's happening there?
Yeah, Amy, I think it's best understood if you step back and think that the science, in order to mitigate global warming, the science is very clear. We have to cut our emissions worldwide by 70%, and that threatens the survival of the coal and oil industry. We need a rapid global transition to clean energy. Unfortunately, the White House, under the Bush administration, has become the East Coast branch of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and those companies and those industries are really calling all the shots for climate and energy policy in this White House. So the regulations that you're talking about are very weak, and they're essentially being written by the lobbyists from big oil and big coal. And that's really what we're seeing in the Bush administration.
Now, in response to what has taken place, the cutting of the restrictions, they're saying now it's only until September 15th, on clean air regulations. So they say it's to deal with the shortage of oil.
I can understand that, and I'm sympathetic to that. The explanation I heard is that different states have different requirements for different kind of mixes of gasoline. Some require a component of ethanol and so forth. Because of the shortage, because of the damage to the refineries and the rigs, they're saying suspend those regs for another month or two. Let us just get whatever gasoline out we can, and then we'll go back to these mandated formulas when we're able to do that. So I'm not unsympathetic to that if it remains a temporary suspension.
And your response to the growing drumbeat in much of the media now, of the commercial or corporate media, preparing the American public for increased oil prices as a result of the situation in the Gulf right now and the hurricane aftermath?
I think that you're seeing some gouging going on. I think you're definitely going to see these prices going up. This also is taking place against the background of a larger trend toward depletion of oil, and we're passing what's called peak oil globally, which means we're going to see a very rapid decline in oil supplies. So the emphasis may be short-term on the increased price of gasoline. There should be right now a worldwide effort to move toward clean energy. And the United States stands in very stark contrast to what's happening in Europe. As I mentioned, the science says we need to cut emissions by 70%. Right now, Holland is cutting her emissions by 80% in 40 years. Tony Blair has committed Britain to cut emissions by 60% in 50 years. The Germans have committed to 50% cuts in 50 years. French President Chirac recently called on the entire industrial world to cut emissions by 75% by the year 2050. So I really think that while we're looking at higher gasoline prices in the short term, we really need to be looking toward an economy based on hybrid cars and hydrogen cars, on electricity that comes from wind and solar and tidal power and so forth. We really need to make this transition very rapidly. Otherwise, we're going to see many more natural disasters and a much more fractured and combative and degraded kind of civilization.
Ross Gelbsman, I wanted to get your response to a piece that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wrote, "For they that sow the wind shall reap the whirlwind." He says, as Hurricane Katrina dismantles Mississippi's Gulf Coast, it's worth recalling the central role that Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour played in derailing the Kyoto Protocol and kiboshing President Bush's ironclad campaign promise to regulate CO2. In March 2001, just 2 days after EPA Administrator Christy Todd Whitman's strong statement affirming Bush's CO2 promise, former RNC chief Barbour responded with an urgent memo to the White House. Barbour, who'd served as RNC chair and Bush campaign strategist, was now representing the president's major donors from the fossil fuel industry, who'd enlisted him to map a Bush energy policy that would be friendly to their interests. His credentials ensured the new administration's attention. This is the current Mississippi governor, who has flown over the devastated area and is talking about what a massive disaster it is, comparing it to the destruction of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima.
Absolutely. And what Bobby Kennedy wrote is absolutely right. And it's an illustration of what I'm talking about. Shortly after he took office, the president reneged on his campaign promise to cut emissions from power plants. He then ordered the EPA to remove all references to the damages of global warming from its website. Vice President Cheney came out with his energy plan calling for 1,900 new power plants, most of them coal. This is a fast track to climate hell. And, of course, the president withdrew us from the Kyoto Protocol. So he is really going in the opposite direction from the rest of the world. And he really is following the dictates of the fossil fuel lobby. There's no question about it.
And what can Americans who are concerned about the lack of attention and of our federal government to this issue, what can they do?
Unfortunately, it has to be political action. It's not lifestyle action. Even if we all sat in the dark and rode bicycles, it would not stop global warming, especially given the reliance on coal in India and China and on oil in Mexico and Nigeria and the developing countries. We need to take the lead in spearheading a rapid transition to clean energy. That will happen only through political pressure and hopefully through pressure on the United States from a lot of the European countries that are already moving in that direction. I would just make a short plug in my book, Boiling Point, that'll be out in paperback next month. The last chapter deals with a set of policy strategies that would propel this kind of transition. This is not a technology issue. We have all these renewable sources right now. It's really a political issue. And so I would urge people to take political action to force this kind of change.
Ross Gelbsman, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And Boston, author of Boiling Point, How Politicians, Big Oil, and Coal, Journalists and Activists Are Fueling the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do to Avert Disaster. That does it for today's broadcast. Just two notes. I want to let people know that Pacifica Radio, the foundation, is looking for a new executive director, and you can go to the website at pacifica.org. We will also link to it at democracynow.org. And a very special thanks to our Nell Geiser, who we met when she was 13, has worked with us for many years, and has been working with us over the summer, but now returns to school at Columbia University, which, by the way, has announced that it will accept all students at Tulane University during this time of disaster. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Special thanks to Marie Galed, Angela Alston, Chris Zucker. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.